And also a special welcome for all those people overseas who are tuning in on their computers. These talks are live streamed. And those are also recorded and put on for download afterwards. And sometimes someone told me the record, one of my talks, I don't know which it was, 500,000 downloads. That's a full talk. 500,000. So a lot of people listen to these talks. When I go overseas, you know, people say, oh, I saw you on YouTube. Now I see you live. Anyway, for the talk this evening, as usual, that I'm very open to people making suggestions. And a suggestion this evening, just 10 minutes before I came in here, was to talk on how to deal with confusion. Very general subject, but it's nice to know, just, you know, life is sometimes confusing and you have a lot of confusion in your mind from time to time, and what do we do with it? How do we find some sort of way through that thicket of confusion? And so I'm going to tell a few stories, as I usually do, because I like saying similes because they convey the message of what confusion is and how to overcome it much better than just, you know, just mere words. To paint a story rather than tell a story. So one of the great ways I figured out how to overcome confusion was a time when I was 18, and I went to, just before going up to university, went over to the United States, you know, just didn't have a gap year, but a gap 3 or 4 months. And I got really bored with being in the US, it was just like any other country. And just to the south, over the border, was Mexico and a little bit south in the jungles of Central America. And that was really interesting because there were some indigenous cultures over there which were totally different than anything which I had known. And so I went into the jungles of the Yucatan Peninsula in bordering Mexico and Guatemala. And I always wanted to go and visit those great pyramids in the middle of the jungles. And those were 1969. There was no other way to get to that central part of the jungle except on old buses and fishing boats and trucks on the back of heavily laden trucks going through the jungle. It was like an adventure. And I always remember just going down this river which separated Belize, British Honduras, and Guatemala. And, you know, it was literally just jungle on either side. Any moment I expected Tarzan to come swinging through on the trees. And there was a dugout boat with a couple of Indians, indigenous jungle dwellers, totally naked. And I remember we stopped at the cafe. And the cafe was this old thatch and bamboo hut which served this incredibly thick and sweet coffee and black beans with tortilla. Absolutely delicious. Probably terrible for your health, but absolutely delicious. And just going from there to the end of the river and then on the back of a truck and for about 3 days traveling through the jungle until you got to the pyramids in Tikal. And as soon as I arrived there, there was, I think, one person, supposed to be maybe an archaeologist, was fossicking around, but no one else was there. It was no sort of place where you had to pay entrance fees, no shop selling artifacts or selling cups of tea. It was absolutely totally sort of free, and no signs telling what you could do, what you couldn't do. So I was an 18-year-old boy. So you know what 18-year-old men do when they see a pyramid? Climb it. Don't know why we do those things, but so I climbed it, not knowing what I'd find at the top. But when I got to the top of this pyramid, it's a long way up there, I found a story about confusion and about insight and about wisdom and about truth. Because I was told that these pyramids have some religious or spiritual significance, but I hadn't any idea what. I couldn't afford any guidebook, and I hadn't done any research at all about those ancient Mayan civilization, they disappeared, and no one actually knows why they disappeared. And so it was totally unknown. It's beautiful if you can have what we call like this open, empty mind whenever you face any experiences. Because if you expect to find something, if you know what you're supposed to see, it spoils the whole experience. You're not open to truth and seeing things in incredible, beautiful ways. And so as soon as I climbed on the top of that pyramid, it was obvious to me what they were there for. Because I'd spent 3 days, at least, travelling in the jungle. And if you've ever been in real rainforest, real jungle, which hasn't been developed, you'll find that any road or path they cut through the jungle, within a few days, gets covered over with this jungle which is full of life. Trees, branches, they all cover over the path. So you are literally travelling through tunnels. And I'd never seen the horizon for 3 days. I'd never seen any far distances. And now, for the first time in 3 days, I climbed up to the top of that pyramid, and it was just above the tree line. And now I could see the horizon, these great distances. And first of all, I thought, wow, what it would be like to have been born in that jungle. Spent all your life never seeing far distances. And for the first time, some priest takes you up to the top of that pyramid. And now you can see infinity in all directions, with nothing between you and the infinite. In every direction. Wow. The metaphor was so striking, you understand why sometimes when we put things between you and whatever you take to be the infinite, in other words, religions, that blocks you experiencing the vast emptiness and space. There's no barriers there. As you stand on top of that pyramid and see forever, in every direction. And of course afterwards then I looked down at the jungle and you could see where you'd come from. And it took days to get there, but you know, because it was jungle, you can't travel fast. It's not like the freeway. It takes forever. And on the top there you can see these great distances. I could see the village which I'd slept in the night before. It wasn't that far away. And you got the what I call these days a Google Map view of the jungle. Now, I was not confused. And I use that simile about how to overcome confusion in life, wherever it happens to be. Because confusion is like you're right inside the jungle, and you can't see great distances. All you can see is the next tree, the next vine, the next bush. And you know, you don't know where you are, where you should go, or even where you've come from to arrive here. And the obvious solution when there's confusion is to try and find, metaphorically, a way to get out of that jungle. A tree, a tower, or in this case a pyramid. So you're actually out of your confused little lifestyle, that your entangled web of relationships, emotions, where you're climbed out beyond the thicket of thoughts. And when you climb out above that, you can see from above, all the confusion is resolved. Not only can you can see where you've come from, you can see where you need to go, the path to go on. You can also understand why you had to come that way. And the greatest thing is to be above all of that thinking, emotions, difficulty, entanglements. You're so high above all of that for a little while that you can see this great emptiness, infinity, foreverness, which embraces and covers everything and gives it some meaning. Wow! So I always thought that that was the meaning of those great pyramids. Only works in the jungle because it gives you that few moments where you're totally free of confusion. So now you can go back into the jungle, which we all belong in, and just go working. You know exactly where you are, what you should be doing, and how you should be traveling. But the point is, how can we find those little pyramids or tall trees or mountains which are above and beyond, you know, the jungle, the confusion of our life? And of course, I think that you should probably understand now that we're coming on to this spiritual path of meditation. The way of letting go, finding some peace. The way of actually not trying to solve confusion through thinking about it, but stopping thinking about it. Getting some peace, some freedom. You know, that's also one of the reasons why we have retreat centers and monasteries, why monks like me spend a lot of time developing monasteries, not just here in Perth, but in other states as well, and why the, you know, people give great donations to build monasteries. Why? It's because we do need places which are outside of the usual world. I do remember this story of this man. He was visiting a monastery in Thailand, and he walked into the monastery, and just inside the gate of the monastery, he saw this maybe middle-aged Thai woman sitting on a bench, crying her eyes out, weeping. And being an Australian guy, he thought, now, should I help her? But is this the culturally appropriate thing to do? You know, because you're in a sort of a foreign culture, sometimes you don't know what, you know, what you should do. So, you know, he decided actually not to do anything. So he went inside the temple to do whatever he was supposed to be doing. And about 20 minutes later, he came out and he saw the girl still sitting there on the bench, but she stopped crying. And he thought, well, what the heck, I'm going to try and help her. So, you know, he went up to her, and she could speak some English. And he said, anything I can do to help? She said, no, I'm fine now. He said, what was the trouble? She said, I lost my car keys. And I was so upset. I just needed a quiet place to cry. And she found that in the temple. She didn't need anybody to tell her what to do. Now, the emotional confusion of a small thing like that, but for her it was, you know, big. The emotional confusion, all it needed was a quiet place just to allow all of that to vanish, and so the confusion could disappear. This is actually one of the great ways that we can overcome what we call confusion. Now, this morning, or this afternoon, I was conducting a funeral for that poor young man. You may have seen him in the news or in the newspapers last weekend, who got crushed by his own car. You know, his family support this temple. And the confusion of, you know, a young boy, really good man, why he had to die. And sometimes all the words and the comforts and the hugs and the compassion, that doesn't really stop the confusion when somebody is, you know, emotionally, understandably, you know, in turmoil. A mother and a father that one day had a very good son and just in a few minutes had died, crushed by his own car. And how does one overcome that? And every now and again we'll always have that sadness, that grief, the confusion on what we should do. Sometimes all we need is not to be told what to do, but have a place we can go, a quiet place, where we can just climb above the confusion of life, climb above the thoughts and the advice which people keep giving us, just to be. And you will find that there we tend to find the solutions. There the emotions have a chance to settle down, the thoughts get slower, and we can actually see what we need to be done. A simile which my master Ajahn Chah said, he said, no, in the forests, you know, the leaves are falling all the time. You know, we're always spending time sweeping the paths in forest monasteries. And when a leaf falls in the jungle, you can't really see it because there's so many other leaves and twigs there. But if you just swept a path and one leaf falls on that clear path, it really stands out. And you can actually understand it, you can get to know it, you can see its colors, you can understand what it really is. only when a leaf falls on an empty path. A leaf falls in a forest and it's just confused with all the other leaves and twigs. And this was a symbol of insight, understanding, of confusion. Sometimes there's so much going on in our lives, it's just too much that we can't understand anything, which is one of the also the benefits of where we can go to a quiet place, we can meditate, we can just relax a little bit, because just the amount of leaves in your forest are less, that when something does actually arise, you can understand it much better. It's not just another leaf in the tangled mass of leaves in the forest floor. It's one leaf on a clear path. And then we can actually start to understand what it really means. What it is for grief, what it is for fear, what it is for why we worry about the future. When there's so many things we have to do, it just gets far too confusing. So this is one of the benefits of going to quiet places. Why people would actually go, in Australia, out into the bush if you're confused. Just to be by yourself for a while. Or why you can just go for a walk on the beach. But don't think about things, because that's just more leaves which are tangling up, you know, the one leaf you're trying to figure out what its meaning is and what you should do. Just see if you can allow just yourself, if you're walking by the beach, just to be absorbed into the sound of the waves just crashing onto the sand. You know, listen if you're in the forest to the sound of the birds or the wind rustling in the forest trees. Have something which calms you down so you can get some freedom from the thinking. That is your little pyramid to get above the confusion of thoughts. And if you can do that, you find you become peaceful. And when you become peaceful, you know, it's just like one leaf, this one problem, and you can actually see it, you know, in perspective. And you find then there's so many solutions you can find to what we call confusion. So you don't find the answers to confusion. I apologize to any therapist here. You don't find the answers to confusion by going to see a psychologist. You find the answers to confusion by getting some solitude, being by yourself. And unfortunately, in our modern world, it's so hard to find solitude and peace and quiet. Again, I remember the story that I used to, you know, whenever I was confused, you know, I used to go to these great churches. They had these beautiful cathedrals in London when I was young. And I remember the last time I ever went into a cathedral, this was in England, in London, was actually Westminster Abbey, this huge, cavernous place where I could just go and just sit down and be quiet. Outside was all the noise of the traffic in London. You go inside, it was just absolutely silent. You can sit down, relax, and find answers to any problems. You didn't need to be told, you just need to be relaxed and be still. And the last time I went in there, I was very, very upset, I must admit, because I went in there, it was a refuge of silence and peace, you know, my little pyramid in London where I could get above everything, the jungle of people and traffic and noise. But then when I went in there, they had just a week or two before installed a PA system throughout the whole complex. They're having all these announcements and sermons and stuff. And so the silence had disappeared. And I thought that was sacrilege, because the most sacred part of that old ancient building was the silence, and it was not there anymore. And to this day I thought that that was one of the great reasons why they had those immense cathedrals, because they were celebrating and worshipping silence. It was in that silence, in that peace outside, where people could relax and they could become still enough to actually find answers to their confusion. You didn't need a priest to come up and tell them anything. You just needed the time to be still, to be peaceful, to climb out of the jungle, to just have the one leaf falling on the empty path so you can fully understand what it meant and find a solution. The solutions are quite easy when you see them, but when you're entangled, it's hard to find a way through. So the best way of overcoming that confusion is through a little bit of silence. And it's amazing just the power of that. I always remember this one lady who she was a senior social worker. She came on one of my retreats in North Perth when we used to, before we had our Jhana Grove Retreat Centre. And if you've ever been to that Redemptorist Monastery in North Perth, it's a little island, you know, which is really quiet. And if you go inside there, there's a beautiful garden in the back there. So it's not that bad for finding some peace and quiet. But, you know, she was a senior social worker. And she told me the sort of problems she had to deal with was actually deciding, you know, whether, you know, to take children away from their mothers because their mothers were drug addicts. And that's just a tough decision to make, because even if your mummy is, you know, a very heavy taker of heroin or methamphetamines, you know, it's still the mother, and the mother loves the kids, and the kids need a mother. And it was just one of those heart-wrenching decisions, and somebody has to make it. And she was a person who had to put her signature on, take the kids away. And really, really stressful and a hard thing to decide. And so when she came on the retreat, she was just came really late. She was stressed out. And so the first few days she just relaxed, slept a lot. And I remember her coming up to me and just in an interview time and saying an amazing thing happened. Now, she had all these problems she had to solve, and it was just so confusing. Just like you, you know, maybe this is the weekend, and you think, okay, now I'm on holiday. Your work hasn't finished. There's many decisions you have to make, and they're just so confusing. How can I make those decisions? But she was smart enough not to even to think about all those very important decisions she would have to make when she went back to work. She just rested and became still. And she told me that as she was meditating, she hadn't thought of those problems for a couple of days. All the answers came to her. And they were really, really good solutions. And she'd seen through the confusion. She'd climbed a pyramid. And when she was very still, it was like she could get the overview, a bird's eye view, where you could actually get far more understanding of what the problem is and what the solution is. When the things are so close, of course you can't find the answers. That is the next simile which I'm going to give you, which I've been giving this simile for so many years, and I don't know whether to say annoyed. Actually, I laughed. It wasn't really annoyance. When somebody showed me a video of a psychologist over in Sydney who was using this as his main method of treatment, and everybody knew it came from me. No acknowledgement that it came from me, no sort of royalties, but who cares, we're not into money as monks, as long as it works and it helps people. It was the old simile of the hand. Now, how big is my hand, everybody? You know, it's now so big I can't see any of you. I can't see anything in the whole world, all I can ever see is my hand. That's the 100% the totality of my world. Is it my hand's fault? Or is it the fact that I haven't got perspective? If I now put my hand where it belongs, at the end of my arm, I can now see my hand and I can see all of you. I can see so much more in life. See the beautiful decorations outside and the Buddha statue outside. Now, this is one of the reasons why we get confused. You know, say in a death. Or say in, you know, you've broken up with somebody or someone has said something bad to you and it's unfair. Or maybe, you know, this is the season of giving, you know, this week. And I realize it's a season of giving because now if any of you get caught for speeding, you have to give double demerits and double fine. I think that's what the police department mean about the season of giving. Double demerits time already. So, but when you have a problem like that, sort of, a lot of time it's confusing when we put it straight in front of us and that's all we can see. A family have lost their son. Of course, their hand is so close to them that their tragedy is all they can ever see in their life. They can't see anything else. You're broken up with your wife and it's all you can see is just the pain of separation. Now, maybe you've just been diagnosed of having a cancer, that's all you can see. And the trick in overcoming such confusion is to realize that you've got your hand far too close to your eyes. Put it to where it belongs. Yes, a tragedy has happened, but there's so many other things occurring in life. Yeah, you've broken up with your boyfriend, but there's so much more other wonderful things happening. Put it where it belongs, give it perspective. When you can see the full picture there, it's not diminishing what has happened. It's being aware of all the other stuff which is happening alongside the death of your son. All the other stuff which is happening alongside you're losing your job. The confusion is overcome when you get the perspective, climbing above the pyramid, seeing the full picture rather than only a tiny part of life. So when we're right in the jungle, when we only see a small part of life, of course we get confused. And the job of monks like me is not to answer your questions for you, but actually to learn, come on, put your hand where it belongs, put it out here. There's more to life than the thing which, you know, you're already thinking about right now. See the bigger picture and much of your confusion disappears. And it's the same with all the confusion about religions in our world, and, you know, the violent religions and the peaceful religions and the everyone religion saying we're right and everyone else is wrong. Now, can't we actually just climb that pyramid and get the overview of actually what's really happening in this world? You know, I can't sort of resist putting my comment about what happened in Sydney and why people do violent things in the name of religion. And it usually comes down to fear. You know, people are just so afraid, they tend to act violently. And I'm talking about, like, afraid of what might happen to them, of what has been done to them, and sometimes afraid to actually to listen to others and see another side of the story. Sometimes it's being afraid to be wrong. You know, I learned a wonderful thing in life. It's okay to be wrong. It's all right to make a mistake. You don't have to be perfect. Remember that story which I gave about the trees in the forest? The most beautiful trees are the crooked ones, the ones which have got all the scars on their barks. They're the beautiful trees in the forest. And understanding I don't have to be perfect. In fact, the perfect trees in the forest, the ones which are dead straight, with only green leaves on, I don't like them. Do you like them? I like the crooked ones, the bent ones. So I like the imperfect people. I like the people who make mistakes, because they're fun. And I remember just telling you about all the mistakes which I've made. And I say stupid things sometimes. And I did a funeral today, and I remember that time I did a funeral for this Sri Lankan, you know, one of the people who comes in here. They come here every week, and they said, one of my parents is dead, can you come and do the funeral? And it was in Subiaco, and I was too busy. No, it's my mistake, because I should have done a little bit of research and find out which parent it was. So at the funeral, I got up the front there on the lectern. You've been to the crematoriums and stuff. Get up the lectern to welcome everybody. I was the MC and doing the chanting. And I say, today we're gathered here, you know, to pay respect for the tragic loss of this disciple's mother, you know, who passed away. And then this old lady stood up. It's not me, it's my husband who's died. I just got the wrong parent. You know, it happens. And that's caused so much happiness for so many people. And I remember when so much joy happens when people make mistakes. So I love it when people make mistakes, because you can relate to that, because you make mistakes, I make mistakes, and so welcome to the world. And so just knowing you can make mistakes, but too many people are afraid of making mistakes. Too many people are afraid of, you know, being wrong. And it's a beautiful thing to be wrong, to realize that, you know, when I am wrong, that I can learn. And when I'm right, I can celebrate being right. But is it just celebrating being right? Is that the meaning of life? I think being wrong is the meaning of life, because that's when we learn and we grow from. And being afraid of being wrong. And it's also the reason why people, when they're afraid of being wrong, they believe in these books, they believe in these gurus. Please do not believe what I say. Okay? I tell that to one person once, don't believe what I say. You know what? They believe what I said. Okay, that's just messing around with your logic. But, you know, why is it that people, you know, that they have gurus, you know, they have teachers, they have books, they have religion. Look in the book, what does the book say? You know, what does Ajahn Brahm say? You know, what does the Pope say or whatever? Can't you figure it out for yourself? That's why that hopefully when, you know, you come here, I never tell you what to believe. The whole person being a Buddhist monk and actually teaching is teaching people how to find out for themselves. Is actually teaching you so that you can understand just how to solve all these problems so you don't need to bother me ever again. I'm a terrible teacher because some of you have been coming here for years and years and years and years. I always say that, imagine I was a teacher at school and the same class would come every week, every year, and they would never ever graduate. I would get the sack. But it's actually teaching people how to understand, teaching people by giving these little similes, like the pyramid, like the hand, so you can actually get through your own confusion. But because people are afraid, they often rely on books. And someone says it's a holy book, so it must be right. Someone says, Ajahn Brahm, it must be right. It's a pope, infallible, must be right. And this is one of the big problems here. Why do you actually do that? It's a bit of laziness, a bit of fear of actually trying to find out for oneself. It's a fear of the adventure of life, of making mistakes, learning from those mistakes, growing from them, the fear of realizing that you are a crooked tree. And it's beautiful to be a crooked tree, to realize that, you know, this life, there are deaths happen, it's part of life, that we do have these emotional difficulties of, you know, losing our job, losing the people we love very much. Now that's a really important part of life. And you know, you should never ever think that that is wrong. Without those tragedies, you would never grow. Without, you know, my story, without this shit, there's never fertilizer, there's never beautiful, delicious mangoes. And our job is to learn how to use the difficulties in life, to learn how to dig them in, to grow. And after a while, when you understand, you welcome those things. The confusion is a great opportunity to learn, to grow, to understand. This is actually the maturing of a human being. And when you do get that maturity as a human being, you know, any confusion which comes, you know how to solve it. You know, you're right in the middle of stuff. Just leave it aside for a little while. It's very hard for people to let go of stuff. That's why we teach people in meditation, just how to let it go for a little while. And when you let it go for a little while, you do actually start to get perspective. Another little simile about confusion, which I usually use over in meditation retreats. Have ever you seen, maybe I think there's been some cricket on, I saw that in the newspaper. Have ever seen maybe, you know, one of your husband or somebody really loves the cricket, and then sort of they're watching this TV, the cricket over in Sydney or wherever it's happened to be right now, and they, you know, somebody says it's out and you scream at the table, that's not out, that's wrong. Have you ever seen them doing watching the football, maybe the football over in England, and they say, shoot, shoot, offside, and they're shouting at a TV and it's probably a replay. And wherever they are over in England, they can't hear you. Now, don't laugh, you know, the people laughing are the girls because that's your husband shouting at the TV. How many of you have seen your wife or your girlfriend on the TV and it's a movie? Oh, so sad. He's died. Don't have to worry about that. The movie's a repeat. They get reincarnated the next time it's shown. But why is it that we get emotionally involved in movies or sport on the TV? We really get confused. We get absorbed into it. You know, if you ask any person who's watching cricket or tennis or soccer, when they get really involved in it, you know, it's really like they're on the field. Or at least, you know, they're on the grandstand there, so they shout just as if it was a live match. When you're watching a movie, it's like you're right inside the screen. I still remember as a kid watching these horror movies. I used to like horror movies because they were fun. I still remember seeing this movie called Tarantula. If any of you remember this little tarantula who was involved in some nuclear accident and became this mutant monster tarantula eating everybody. You know, the typical... I don't think that movies have changed that much since I was a kid. But, you know, tarantula, you know, is creeping up on somebody. You know, it's always a beautiful girl. If you're an ugly girl, I would say you're safe. Because these monsters, they only go after the beautiful girls. So anyways, going after this beautiful chick in the movie. And of course, someone in the audience, it's the film, shouts out, "Look out behind you!" I just burst out laughing. The tarantula can't hear you. It's a spider, doesn't have ears. I don't know, do spiders have ears? I don't know. But anyway, it's a movie, they can't hear. But they always shout it out because people get involved in the movie. And I told people, imagine that, you know, you're seeing a movie or you're seeing some sports match. Imagine you just sit back and you realize you're on the sofa in your house and it's just a movie on a screen. It means you're not emotionally involved anymore. You've got a bit of perspective, a bit of detachment, space between you and the movie. And you realize then, shouting that there's tarantulas behind you, look out, is a waste of time. Shouting at the umpire, "That's not out," is a total waste of time. You can just let it go. And this is some of the reasons why we can overcome confusion by not getting totally involved in it, not putting ourselves emotionally in the middle of it, but just learning how to stand back. This is just life, and I am a visitor in this life, passing through like somebody on a coach, you know, which is passing through this particular part of the countryside. But I'm in the coach and I'm looking through the window at everything which is happening outside. When you can get an emotional distance, you know, from the confusion, no matter what it is, you do notice that this is part of the journey. This too will pass. When you're right involved in it, you can never get that perspective. You think this is it and it's painful and it's going to be the same forever. It's incredible that when you get that distance, that's one of the first things you notice. This is just a show which is passing. The tragedy of today will soon be forgotten this time next year. Impossible as that might seem if you're really involved in the confusion, when you can get some perspective, you know how true that is. That's one of the great teachings, such a simple teaching. No matter how confusing it is, if you can't find a solution, you don't need to. It will pass by itself. Which means you can just leave it alone and get on with other things in life. Some pleasant, beautiful things. Knowing it does change. Of all the truths in life, that's probably the most easiest to understand. And very often that if I have a problem, I just leave it alone. If I can't find a good solution, wait for a while. It's like the simile of, you know, when you are confused and you think you have to make a choice. You don't always have to make a choice. You can just leave it aside. It's like you're on a crossroads in life and you don't know which way to go next. I always say, if that's the case for you, at a crossroads, big decisions have to be made. Sit down at the crossroads and wait for the bus. You don't need to make a choice yet. Because buses come along, and if you notice on a bus, on the front of the bus, it's got the destination where it's going to. So on the crossroads, you wait, you don't know which way to go, and if the bus comes, and you look at the front of the bus, and the destination is where you want to go, get on it. If the destination is not where you want to end up, then don't get on it, sit down. There's always another one coming behind. And that is a metaphor for how to make difficult decisions in life. An idea comes up, check it out. If that's really where you want to go, go with it. But if, no, that's not really a good solution, wait. There's always another solution coming behind. And maybe the next one will be the destination where you want to go. And then you go with it. The trouble is that people are so impatient these days. They don't know how to wait and allow life to unfold for you rather than try to make it unfold. And that's been my life. Sometimes you don't know what to do. So when I don't know what to do, what do? Do nothing. And wait for a while until solutions come. And I trust that method so much. I know a solution eventually comes. Sometimes that I don't know what I'm going to do, how I'm going to solve this problem. But then after a while, you wait for a while, and solutions, they do come. Things pass. Life is always evolving. And I'm open to those evolving moments. Always waiting for the right thing to come at the right time, and then I take it. So this is actually how we overcome those confusing moments of having to make a decision and don't know what decision I should make. Sometimes in those making of decisions, which is again very confusing, sometimes people think, oh, but that doesn't work, Ajahn Brahm. I have to make a decision. And I haven't got time. I've waited long enough and now I've got to make a decision. And I always remember this time, I was in Oslo University, giving a talk. And sometimes, when I travel around, you always learn new things. That's why sometimes I love traveling. That's a lie, because I hate traveling. But, there are some advantages, isn't it? I was trying to say, travel too much. Somebody was telling me the other day, I came back from Japan early on Monday morning, 2 a.m., and at the sort of Bodhinyana Monastery for the lunch at 10:30, somebody came up and they told me, said, that life, as they saw this program, apparently it was on TV, The Meaning of Life. They said that life is a journey, not the destination. And I've just been on this long journey. If I say, if life is a journey, I hate life. I've had enough of journeys. Being in an aircraft for 16 hours and being really coming home late and going through all the customs and immigration and waiting and being checked for this and checked for that. Actually they're checking for Ebola now. You've got to fill in a form whether you've been to any of these African countries now. Whew, just so many forms to fill in just to travel. And so if life is a journey, I've had it. I said, life is not, the meaning of life is not a journey, it is a destination. I've arrived back home in the monastery, I can relax. There's no place which is more comfortable than your own bed. For me, my own floor is the most comfortable bed. My cave is the best 5-star hotel in the world because that's where I live. Home is the best and home cooked food is always the best. You know what it's like. So all this travel business, if life is, the meaning of life is a journey, no way. The meaning of life is the end of the journey. When you've come home to your loved ones, comfortable, and you can relax a while and rest. That's the meaning of life, learning how to rest at the end of a journey and enjoy it. And don't journey on again too soon. You work hard, you travel so far. Pause and enjoy. This is holiday time now. For goodness sake, those of you who have finished work today, you lucky things. I never finish work, but I enjoy myself. Please don't do too much over the holiday season. Be lazy. I really encourage laziness, doing nothing. Be really lazy. Being lazy, I don't mean like watching the TV and just reading books. Be really lazy. Learn how to do absolutely nothing. Just sit in your garden and just watch. I call it watching the trees grow. Have you ever seen a tree grow? If you haven't, it's because you're too impatient. get a chair out in the garden, sit down, and if your wife asks, what are you doing, darling? I say, I'm watching the trees grow. Shh. They're going to grow. They do grow, you know. But a lot of times they grow when you're not watching them, so you've got to be very careful and watch for a long time. Yeah, got it. In other words, learn how to sort of enjoy life and doing nothing. That's the meaning of life. It's when the journey has ended and you can relax and rest and be with people, be with yourself, be with nature, be with things. So a lot of times that, you know, when we have a choice to make, sometimes learn how to stop and enjoy. It's amazing how all the solutions come, not when you're searching for them, but when you're just being still. But anyway, the story in Oslo, which I was got totally sort of, confused with, I went off on a tangent. It's how to make decisions in life. This poor lady, I can't forget this incident. She was sitting in the audience, question time. Ajahn Brahm, yeah, very good, but I have a really important decision to make in life. Please help me. How can I make this decision? I can't wait. And be very careful when you ask a monk like me, because I sussed her out 100% straight away. And I said, well, you know, let's give this question, you know, a little bit more grounding in reality. Let's just suppose the question is whether you should marry that boy sitting next to you. And that poor girl, she put her hands in her head and went beetle red, because that was the question she was thinking of. So be careful you ask a question of a monk. You know, I mean, there are some powers around. So I shouldn't have done that. I just apologize afterwards. But, you know, that was a question. And said, oh, it's very easy. Now, who are you going to spend your life with? You know, one of the biggest questions and decisions you have to make. And I said, this is a big decision. And this is how you can make it, whether you're going to marry that guy or not. Toss a coin. But then I said the important part. Toss a coin, decide, heads I marry him, tails I don't. Say. And you toss the coin, say it comes up, tails I don't. How do you feel? What's the emotional reaction to that? Tails, I won't marry him. Do inside of yourself just say, yes. Or do you think, let's do 2 out of 3. If it's yes, it means that's uncovering, you know, your deeper emotions, what you really feel inside. If it's 2 out of 3, it's uncovering you really want to marry that guy. So go for it. So the tossing the coin is not to make the decision for you. It's actually to reveal what you really want to do. And a lot of times that where we think, we don't know what we really want to do. So that tossing the coin is just a way of overcoming, getting beyond your thoughts, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, you know, being told by your parents whether you should get married or you shouldn't get married, and just thinking about it and asking your friends or reading it in the book or asking your guru or whatever. All of that sort of stuff is so confusing. Find out how you feel. Toss a coin. Should I take this job or should I not take the job? And straight away, how do you feel when it comes up? Take the job. And psychologists, people doing so many experiments have proved convincingly again and again, if you follow that feeling inside, that is accurate. That is the one to follow when you have a choice to make and it's very confusing. Should I retire and become a monk? Toss the coin. Heads, I become a monk. Tails, I wait for another year. Toss the coin. And how it feels, tails, wait for another year. No! That shows you want to become a monk. Toss the coin. Heads. Yes. And this is actually how you understand what to do, how to cut through that confusion. Because again, the confusion is like the jungle of thoughts, the jungle of the words in the books, you know, the Quran, the Tripitaka, the guru's teachings, the Bible, what that says. What am I supposed to do? You can't trust those things. But you certainly can trust what goes on inside of you. When you go out of the jungle of ideas and thoughts and words, you climb that pyramid, you start to feel, you start to know, you start to see, then you are outside of confusion. You can see what needs to be done. And life becomes so simple then. You know exactly what to do. And that is the way to have a very happy and beautiful life. Free your confusion. Thank you for listening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, how about some questions now? First of all, from the audience here, before we go overseas. Okay, so let's see what we've got from overseas. Okay. Because people actually have the opportunity to listen online. And, oh, this is an interesting question. The first one is from the North Pole, from Santa Claus. How can I decide which boys have been good and bad?
I just made that up.
Here from the United States. Okay, this is not on the talk, on something else. I can forgive my former abuser, but I'm compelled to take action by seeing the cycle of destruction continue on other defenseless women and children. He was once taken to court but got off scot-free, and it seems there's not much I can do to bring him to justice and save the current victims. What should I do? It's again like physical or sexual abuse on people has huge negative problems. This is why we have laws and why we have organizations which are supposed to take that person. And if it's, I never actually agree with justice being revenge and punishment, but sometimes the people who abuse others, they have to be obviously restrained and learn that that is unacceptable. I know that very often that people who abuse others will abuse themselves, but even that's not an excuse. My own father was physically abused by his father, and he was beaten mercilessly for doing nothing many, many times. But even though he suffered physical abuse, this is my paternal grandfather, my own father, he told me that whenever he was on the end of a belting, you know, with a big leather belt for doing nothing, that he made a resolution as a young kid. If ever I have children, he would never use corporal punishment. He never could. A few times we deserved it, but he just no way could he do it, because that was his resolution. He had been a victim of abuse, but learned what it felt like. He would never, ever do that to another person. You have actually a choice there. Being abused, you know, you can visit it on somebody else, or you can learn from it and become a beautiful person. You know, he was one person who did dig in the shit and become a great person as a result of it. So, for yourself, the person who asked this question, you try to see what you can do. If there's nothing you can do, you have to let it go. But for you, you know, you had a lot of shit, please dig it in. Grow from it, become kind. Don't sort of feel that, you know, there's something wrong with you. You know, if you are what is called damaged goods, remember the story of the trees. Damaged trees are the most beautiful. So you are a beautiful person from the United States. Never allow anyone else to make you doubt that. But you do have responsibilities, if there's something to do, to make sure that that person doesn't abuse other people. If you take it to court and it doesn't work, then maybe try again if it's at all possible. If there's nothing much you can do, then eventually this karma will catch up with the person. So as far as justice is concerned, there's two types of justice in this world. You know, the justice of the courts. There's also this natural justice of karma. So that's why that if there's nothing you can do through the court system, if there really is nothing you can do, then just wait for karma to catch up with him. And as for you, to make sure that, you know, you dig in what's happened to you and become a beautiful person. And you can do that. Another question from Germany. I am very I'll say emphatic, I think you mean empathetic, and feel people's sadness, confusion, negative feelings. Is there a way to protect oneself from that by means of meditation? In other words, you know, you meet people who are sad and you feel their sadness. Please don't totally abandon that, because it's wonderful actually to have empathy for other people. But don't just have empathy for when they're sad. Have empathy for when they're happy as well. To celebrate when other people are celebrating. You know, to see other people who are happy and feel their happiness as well. When somebody is smiling, you smile as well. There's so much joy and happiness in this world, and we can actually share that as well. And when people say empathy, they always mean empathy for the pain of life. But when you do have empathy for the pain in life, please remember that pain, the sadness, the confusion, negative feelings, that, you know, they don't last, and they have happy feelings afterwards. It's just like the heat and then the cold which come in people's lives. If there's something to do, then please help them. But don't become like some sort of robot where you don't have empathy for anybody. And I say that, you know, part of my job, you know, is being like a bit of a counselor. And I say, when somebody's in big trouble, I know that psychologists say this is the last thing you should do, but I really disagree with them here. When someone's in a big trouble, it's like they're in this deep pit. And I know the only way to help is actually to get in the pit with them. Really to go into their hole and feel what they feel. But when I go into someone's hole, I always manage to take a ladder with me so I can get out and I can bring them out as well. But you've got to feel what they feel. And sometimes it's difficult to do that, and you can't really feel it totally. You can allow just their pain just to come inside your heart. Feel what they feel. Otherwise, how can you understand where they are, and how can you actually do any help? You know, sometimes that's all you really need to do. Have someone to have their pain acknowledged. Someone realizes and understands and accepts, you know, what they've been through. Sometimes that's empathy is a solution. You don't need to bring the ladder for them. Once they know that, yeah, they are validated, then there's a way out. Meditation, yes. Wisdom, yes. Last question from Malaysia. I'm always confused with the keeping the first precept, not killing, because part of my job is to take care and protect the cocoa crop, which requires me to spray a lot of insecticide. This will directly kill all the insects around. What is your comment about this? So all you people eating chocolate over the holiday season, you know that as many insects have to be sprayed because of this. There's one of our members, a past president, asked me a few days ago that her house was infested with termites. And they were asking me just what they can do. You know, they were devout Buddhists. And I said, now, have you tried everything? He said, yes. And the house was actually built with so-called termite protection. But, you know, somehow or other, the termites got in. And they tried everything to sort of try and make sure the termites don't get in, but they keep coming in and in and in and in. And, you know, my comment about that, you know, as a Buddhist, you may find this a little bit on the edge, but when you've tried everything else, you really have tried everything else. As I told her then, just to ask forgiveness of the termites, because, you know, you're going to have to bring in the exterminator. Do it as compassionately as you possibly can. And try and do some good karma to actually to balance, you know, the bad karma of killing. And so I asked her to make a donation. And what she actually decided to do, to try and find some sort of charitable donation, which is as close as she can do, you know, to realizing that they're going to be killing termites. So she gave a big donation to the homeless charity. And I thought that was quite a nice thing to do. Because unfortunately, you know, in our life, we cannot live our life, you know, without sort of killing some animals. Even just me coming from Serpentine to here, you see always these bugs on the windscreen every evening. And I do remember somebody actually showed me it was an advertisement, I think it was for Mercedes-Benz cars, and had this Mercedes-Benz car swerving all over the road, and just, you know, on this, you know, 1 minute ad. And once it parked, a Buddhist monk came out and he said he was avoiding the insects on the road. And Mercedes-Benz has that degree of control. So you try your very best, but, you know, after a while, you know, we can't do anything more. So the precept, you know, is to refrain from intentional killing. This is from Malaysia, to refrain. It doesn't mean thou shalt not kill. Refrain. In other words, you know, you don't do it unless it's, you've tried every possible option and there's nothing really more you can do. And so it's very, very rare you break your precepts, but sometimes you have to. And the other example of that is the precept on lying. Because I always like to tell this story of one of the members here. His name was Don. He was English. He used to be in the Royal Navy, and he came to Perth in the boat and liked it so much that once he retired, he came to live here. And he had a heart attack. He was put in Royal Perth Hospital, put in the fast stream for having bypass surgery. And I went to see him in the hospital, give him a bit of a boost. And just the night before his surgery, his wife called me. She was very, very disturbed. And she said, I've been married to him for about 40 years now. And this afternoon I lied to him for the first time and I feel terrible. And so I asked, what happened? Why did you lie? And she said, in that ward there were three other beds. And in his next bed, you know, all people about to have heart bypasses, was Jack. And, you know, being in the ward together, even 2 or 3 days, nothing else to do, you know, he became quite friendly to Jack. And Jack had that heart bypass that morning. And I went to see my husband in the evening, and he was to have his bypass the next day. And so my husband asked, how's Jack? How did his bypass go? And I lied to him. I said, fine, he's over in the ICU recovering. It was a success. When what really happened, I saw Jack's wife crying her eyes out. He died. The bypass didn't work. And I didn't want to tell my husband that his friend had died from the same operation my husband's going to have tomorrow. I think that might have killed him. And actually, that because he was quite elderly, he was on the edge of life and death for about 2 or 3 days. He only just pulled through. And to this day, I say to his wife, you probably did the right thing. If you'd have told the truth, it might have just pushed him over the edge. It might have killed him. So I said, in that particular case, it was the right thing to do to lie. So I say, once every 40 years, you can lie. The same with, like, killing. Just, you know, if it's just every now and again, if you have to, then fine. But, you know, try and do something to try and alleviate that. See if there's any other way to protect the cocoa crops and the other crops. People find all these other ways, like companion planting and stuff like that, if it's at all possible. And for each one of us to realize that the chocolate which we eat, there's somebody like this fellow from Malaysia, has to be the one who takes care and protects them and sprays the insecticide. So, you know, even eating chocolate, there is the expense of people's lives, or not people's lives, but, you know, some insects' lives. So we try and don't waste anything. So please, if you have a bar of chocolate, please eat it all up over Christmas. Lives were sacrificed. So this is the difference between commandments and precepts. In precepts, we refrain, we try and the best we possibly can to try and make sure that we don't break these precepts. And realize their danger. When you go through a red traffic light, it's against the law, it's dangerous. But if I have a heart attack this evening and you put me in your car, I do hope you go through the red traffic lights as long as it's safe. The precepts are red traffic lights. They're dangerous to go through. Exceptional circumstances, you may go through them. Okay, any questions from here before we finish off? Okay, there'll be some in the line afterwards. So thank you again for coming this evening. I hope the talk was useful for you. I always try and do the best I can to make sure that any questions or any subjects I can actually answer as best I can. And hopefully you can find something useful in what I've said. If there's something you disagree with, please forgive me, because whenever you give a talk, you can't have everything which people agree with. But hopefully, if you don't disagree with it, to leave that alone and take back what you really agree with and make better human beings of yourself and for other people as well. Thank you for listening. Let's now pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha.
Arahang Sammasambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.